This is an example of speech.
All our history of broiling war.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment sections in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. You can contact us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at BloatedNemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have weak thoughts about the NRA and Oliver North. Colonel Oliver North? Terrible NFL owner Dan Snyder, congressional term limits, and a Supreme Court ruling about gambling. A Tell Me What to Watch review of Jessica Jones Season 2, a nerdy deep dive into one political graph that we just couldn't get over, and a number of hashtag embarrassing Wisconsin updates. Prepare to get righteous and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some weak thoughts.
Whatever you please, for the night commuters in Uganda, the poor crack babies in Atlanta, for continents, as ravaged by AIDS and transient Asian housemaids from the...
All right, welcome to Tell Me What to Think. This is Weak Thoughts. I'm Peter Elbro, and I'm here with Charles Minnick.
Hello.
Hey, Charles. You can find us on Twitter at BloatedNemesis and Green_Weird, which is WYRD. You can email the pod at tmwttpod@gmail.com.
Oh, and that's on Twitter, by the way, not Instagram or anything.
No Instagram. I just feel as if I would just be an Insta whore if I was on. Isn't that what they call them? Insta whores? So derogatory.
Man, that's...
Isn't that a thing, though? Isn't that what, like, a thing that people say? Talk about? Like...
I think it's like models,
or something.
Mm-hmm. Or porn stars.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. yes, that's not what
or
our
people who sell
is doing.
Images of their naked selves over Instagram. I've heard of that.
Yeah. I think it's pretty popular, though, the Instagram. I feel like I'm just a little, like, too old, out of touch.
I just don't want to take that many pictures. It's a really visual social media, so...
Yeah, you don't just go on there, like... It's all visual, right? I assume.
Yeah, it's all pictures.
All right, we are not 75-year-olds that are doing this podcast. So, yeah, do all the rating and reviewing. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher.
Or at stoneduckmedia.com.
There you go. All right, and the top news for the day, you were live tweeting about UN Security Council, which is talking about Gaza. You want to update the audience on what's, well, the discussion's going on there, and then kind of just what's going on there for those that aren't paying attention?
Well, it was the usual suspects. The United States, of course, Nikki Haley, couldn't bring herself to say the word proportionality in her statements, and said Gaza, like, at least 12 times in 2 minutes. Or Hamas, rather.
Yeah.
It got, like, to the point where one of the other... I don't have my tweets in front of me, but one of the other representatives was like, all we've heard this morning is Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. And instead, what we should be talking about is occupation, occupation, occupation.
Nice. Good line. And so, there's a lot of violence going on there. Is that...
63 dead so far, like over 2,000 wounded in just one day.
Yeah, I heard, like, the total number of wounded was, like, approaching 10,000.
Mm-hmm, for the last 6 weeks. But the real... what makes this kind of messed up is that, like, 2 weeks ago or so, if my memory serves, like, in previous, like, you know, weekends of this protest, like, the Israelis had gotten it down to where there were only, like, dozens injured and nobody dead. But then, all of a sudden, on the day that the embassy is opening, they decide to open fire. I really want to know who changed the rules of engagement. Because previously, Israeli snipers apparently had to get confirmation from a senior officer, which, of course, the time required would, you know, lengthen the amount, or the time in the loop from decision-making to, or target acquisition to decision-making to firing. And that, to my mind, would explain some of the reason why there are so many more deaths yesterday. I have a feeling that the senior officers were like, no, you don't need to ask, just shoot. Which is terrible.
So, it's hard to believe it doesn't have to do with the U.S. move. Not so much the protests, but,
but the retaliation.
But I don't think it's obvious why that would be greater because of, to me it doesn't strike me as obvious, at least, why all of a sudden they would be way more violent in their repression. Like, just, is it just message sending, or?
Signaling? I don't know. That's, like, I tried to get a couple, like, you know, on the Twitter, I was trying to find some answer to that, and there was none forthcoming. The only response that, or the only thing that I'll from the Israelis that I saw that was particularly different and problematic was that an Israeli government spokesperson to Irish TV was like, well, we can't put them in jail, so we have to kill them, when asked why there were so many more casualties.
Yeah, that doesn't really explain it, though.
Yeah, right?
I mean, it explains not a other good explanation, things, but it doesn't really explain that.
So, the UN Security Council was talking around itself, of course, because everybody else, Equatorial Guinea, France even, the UK even was the UK representative actually said the word proportionality in international humanitarian law, so mm-hmm. It's basically the United States and Israel who are making themselves the isolated actors here.
I mean, the UN proceedings that are going on, from just my reading of your live tweeting, made me think this is part of the anti-Iran strategy.
Well, that's what Nikki Haley was trying to make it about. She was like, the common thread is Iran. And all of the violence in Yemen and the Golan Heights and Gaza, it's all Iran. And it's like, well, that doesn't really make sense, ma'am.
Because they are tied in somewhat with some...
I mean, but they don't really support Hamas.
Okay.
And they don't really support the Houthis. I mean, maybe the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, fired those rockets over the Syrian-Israeli border, but... I don't know. Trying to subsume all of the violence in the Middle East to one state actor is myopic and insidious and just downright stupid.
And this seems to be... I mean, I think even some of the comments from the UN representatives was making the events of that are going on now out to be sort of a turning point.
Right. Along with the embassy, because it's a direct violation of, 478 and other UN resolutions.
It was really interesting to me that... I think I saw this. I think this was in your live tweeting. One of them pointed out that they don't. One of the countries doesn't recognize Jerusalem, and this may be a lot of countries, as part of Israel.
Yes, that is France, and almost all the countries in Europe don't.
So if you so that's kind of interesting to think that they don't recognize. Like, what does that mean? Like, what does that, like, kind of, like, on paper mean? That they then don't recognize the existence?
Well, they don't recognize the Israeli administration of East Jerusalem.
No, I mean in terms of the U.S. Embassy. So, like, they don't recognize that as the U.S. Embassy to Israel? Or...
Yeah, that's a little weirder, right? But I mean, that's the reason none of them showed up to the big embassy opening yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very small crowd.
I couldn't get past the opening remarks of Jared, of Kushner. Like, I tried to watch it, and I was like, he just bugs the shit out of me.
I've never heard his voice before, but it's no surprise that it's instantly infuriating to hear. But yeah, his remarks were just painful. Like, besides casting the protesters as responsible for their own deaths, I mean, he was like, because we stand with democracy and human rights, we stand with Israel.
Yeah, that's such an old line in American politics.
It was purely for consumption of the people gathered there and the five people who still believe that.
Yeah, it's like, to think that Israel stands more for human rights than
anyone.
Yeah, anyone. I was going to say, yeah, than anyone, much less Palestine. And democracy, I mean, I don't know the intricacies of Palestinian governing, but, I mean, they have had elections for some of the groups. Because it's different governing organizations in each place, right?
Yeah, Gaza split off in 2007 and took over administration. But in the last year or so, the Palestinian Authority has been trying to rectify that situation. And what was it, 2 months ago, I think, they took over some of the civic administration aspects in Gaza?
I mean, there's no reasonable way you can look at it and say that, like, they represent some sort of antithesis to democracy. Like, it's not about that. What unifies them isn't, like, it's not like, you know, they are waving, I don't know, hammers and sickles or swastikas or something. Like, they're not representing an ideology that is in any way opposite of democracy.
No.
And so, like,
I mean, the Palestinian Authority is pretty dictatorial. Mahmoud Abbas has been in power since Yasser Arafat died and isn't going to, like, relinquish power anytime soon, apparently.
But that's not what But my point is, I mean, but there are countries that we ally with, I mean, that...
Yeah, Saudi Arabia, easy.
yeah, you know, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's not like they represent... So they may not be the most democratic, but it's not like they represent something that's not democratic. They're not trying to push back against Israel because they believe in a different type of government in terms of how leaders are chosen.
It's not a political issue that's causing these protests.
Yeah, that's all I mean. Yeah, it's foolish. So I don't know. I'm going to try and transition here. Speaking of unethical usage of firearms, Ollie North is now the president of the NRA. Is that a fair transition based on his dealings in the 80s?
Right.
Although those were missiles. Was he selling...
No, there were weapons involved.
Okay, yeah, he's all types. Would you still call him a colonel? Is he still a colonel?
He retired as a colonel in the Marine Corps.
Was he honorably discharged? Does that matter in terms of rank?
It does, because usually if you're dishonorably discharged or, like, there's some kind of crime, they reduce you in rank to, like, E1 and kick you out. I'm not sure if he was. I assume he was dishonorably discharged. He was still charged with felonies.
A lot of people still call him colonel, so I don't...
Okay.
Yeah. So, anyway... Oliver North, you know, if you don't know who that is, read up on your history of the Iran-Contra scandal. He was the main, I'm not so much saying patsy, but he was the main fall guy. He was the...
The point man.
Yeah. He actually was convicted, I believe, but then his conviction, I think, was overturned by HW. I think that's correct. I'm sure someone will let us know if that's not correct.
But at any rate, he is now in charge of the NRA.
Yeah, and I would argue he's following in a... It's no, It's not surprising that the NRA would put up a kind of controversial lightning rod troll, for lack of a better word, as their president. They had Charlton Heston back in the day as their president, you know, from my cold dead hands. And it just seems to be their MO, right? Just freak out the libs and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're not trying to reach out to anybody.
Except for maybe other Fox News viewers, because Ali North is on Fox News all the time.
Or is he?
He was for a... Yeah, he would be on, like, Hannity and O'Reilly and all that shit. I don't know specifically recently if he has been, but...
I mean, I guess you'd want an expert in increasing insecurity in our national security, right? Or, you know, just... reducing our national security, weakening it? I'm not sure.
Well, and, you know, I don't want to get too down a rabbit hole that is both conspiratorial and tangled web, but there have been a lot of allegations of the NRA taking money from whatever Russian groups and oligarchs and all that shit. And if you recall... we did an earlier episode of the podcast where we talked about that one guy who was wrapped up in Iran-Contra who was working with Eric Prince now, I believe. And it just seems like whatever's... Old news is becoming new again. It just seems like these old players still have roles to fill within the broad conservative...
movement.
Yeah.
Movement.
Or lack thereof. Oh, they're moving. Yeah, no, they're moving.
Yeah. That steady march towards the future, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I really have much more to add. It just is.
It's fascinating, right? There literally was nobody else. Like, as I said, this is not aimed at anybody but their own loyal supporters. This is the NRA doubling down on their position and putting up a middle finger to anybody who suggests change and reform.
Yeah, and I would say that doubling down part is important. It's not just about it's not about getting like new people or reaching out, and it is about sort of cementing the support you already have, the people you already have.
Yeah, and the controversy.
Yes. They thrive off that. It's not, you know, I'm not saying that, like, the kind of movement against them recently, you know, the Parkland kids and all that, hasn't in any way been effective by any means, but that is a game that the NRA wants to play. Whether or not they'll win, I hope not, and I don't even actually necessarily think so, but that's the game that they like to play and want to play.
Yeah, it's not a winning game. They're putting themselves into a corner that they don't perhaps realize.
I mean,
just think about if they had put, like, basically any actor or musician. I mean, I probably not that one gun-toting
Ted Nugent
ideologue. Yeah, but okay, here's the dark horse candidate, Killer Mike. He'd been on NRA TV.
There's no way they would put him up there.
I mean, but that would be reaching out in a real way.
I see what you're saying, yeah. That would be... and reaching out, you know, not necessarily changing their stance, per se, on gun ownership and rights, but reaching out to different communities and trying to explain away gun ownership for different reasons.
Right, changing the focus of the organization.
Because the NRA, I believe my history is correct, used to advocate for certain gun regulations back in the Reagan and even when, I think actually most notably when Reagan was governor of California, because that was a way to keep guns out of the hands of black people.
Yeah. Well, and like before, it was better for them politically to embrace lighter regulations instead of like letting Congress figure out how deeply they were going to regulate.
Yeah.
And now they're just completely against it, and yeah, it removes the matter out of their hands, to my mind.
All right. All right, well, let's move on to... I wanted to talk about this... I actually don't even know if it's a let me bring it up here. I don't even know if this is a new news story, but I yeah, it's not. This is a 4-year-old news story, but I'm still going to talk about it. It's from Washington Monthly, written by Tim Murphy. It was this great story that I just happened to stumble upon this week about Dan Snyder, who is the owner of the football Washington Redskins. What do you know about Dan Snyder, Charles? Anything?
He doesn't he own, besides the Redskins, he's kind of a businessman, isn't he? He has some kind of conglomerate interests. Not very much, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, he's, I don't know anything about his independent business, but yeah, he must have been rich somehow. He didn't inherit the team.
Right, you don't borrow money to buy a team.
Not more than you have, yeah. although they do make money. And you can make money from a football team with without necessarily, or any sports team without necessarily winning. It's obviously worth pointing out the name Redskins is incredibly racist, and he has been the most vocal antagonist of people saying they should change the name. So, you know, generally a good guy. He's widely considered one of the worst owners in sports. His teams never win, or rarely win. They have not really been a contender for a Super Bowl since he took over. He's greedy. He's not a good owner in terms of the fan base, people who pay money to come to their games, stuff like that. He's pretty widely reviled. And there's this great story about how he bought a home on the Potomac River in a wealthy area. It was previously owned by King Hussein of Jordan.
Holy cow. Like, right there in the, what, across D.C. in Virginia? Right on the river?
No, it's in Maryland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Riverside Estate, I guess. I don't know if it was a little unclear from the article. I don't know if it's just the shoreline itself or if somehow this is like a grandfathered-in property in a national park. But there are these trees that blocked his view of the river, and he wanted them cut down.
What?
And the trees are part of the national park. And... which is jointly run, managed by a, I don't know the exact group, but it, a state group from Maryland. And he spent years trying to get this shit cut down. I mean, this is like corruption and like Washington power play. You know, like, people have spent less work for bigger things than this.
Like, even larger tracts of trees.
I mean, you think the Russia story is complicated with Trump. Like, there was less effort put into that. The worst thing you could say about Trump and the Russia stuff than Dan Snyder put into getting these, like, 400 trees cut down. But no, he spent time. He made connections. The story does a good job of painting the Bush administration's appointing, like political donor appointing within the Department of Interior, as to kind of how this was allowed to happen, because those people were approachable by someone like Dan Snyder, and didn't really care about national parks. There was a whistleblower who was kind of like this. His name's Robert M. Dano. I guess he's since written a book. I love this quote. He had a long career, distinguished NPS veteran, having spent a long career out west, fighting Rocky Mountain forest fires, pulling tourists from a mudslide, and rappelling down a sheer cliff in pitch darkness to rescue a group of scientists. When Yellowstone reintroduced wolves in 1995, Dano was there, literally carrying the first alpha female to the transport caravan.
Aww.
He can recite the agency's authorizing legislation from memory. He, of course, was a Boy Scout. You know, like,
of course he was.
Yeah, this guy. Yeah, that guy. And it's a really complicated story. It involves a lot of higher up people at the national park. What's interesting is that it's not what got me into the story. What got me into the story is the sports angle. Obviously, is this guy who I already thought was a piece of shit doing piece of shit type things. But what's interesting about the story is that this guy becomes sort of a whistleblower. It's like, hey, this stuff's happening. This isn't right. They're cutting down all these trees.
What, the superhero and does superhero things?
Yeah. Yeah. And what's interesting is that a lot of the story is actually then spent on the repercussions to him. That even carried into the Obama administration. Not that, like, probably Obama knew anything about this, but because there were a lot of career officials now in the Department of the Interior, because, you know, Bush had been president for 8 years and was stacking it. And so a lot of these people had allegiances to each other, and they fucked this guy over every which way. And, I mean, they had federal marshals raid his place. They were trying to claim he stole all of these, like, national park badges. He was able to prove definitively he didn't do it. Then they came at him from a different angle, but with the exact same crime. Fought that off, too. But they still had people, like, within the group, within the organization that were sending him to these shitty jobs, being a desk jockey, like, checking, like, license plates and stuff like that. And it was just, it's like a good case study in kind of the bureaucratic blowback of being a whistleblower.
Interesting.
So even if it's not something like national intelligence where you can get charged, like we've seen with like CIA and stuff, but I don't know, it's pretty like almost terrifying in a way.
Yeah,
he had a fight for his career and life and.
Sure, one thing I'd like to add about that is, like, especially at the later part of the Bush administration, his political appointees were joining the civil service, getting their, you know, G-13s, G-12s, like, getting those career positions in the federal government to do things like you're describing, mm-hmm. where they could continue their ideological crusades in the bureaucracy.
Yeah, so all this talk we hear about, by the way, of
deep state.
Like, deep state, fighting against Trump because the Obama... I mean, that's just kind of the nature of presidential administrations and swings of power. Doesn't make it good one way or good both... I don't... You know, I'm not so much talking about good or bad, just...
It just is.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bureaucracy, and they do things that they view as their jobs. In this case, they're being a bunch of assholes, I would argue. In other cases, maybe not as much, and they're just doing the honorable thing. Who knows? But yeah, I mean it's a cool story, and it's just interesting to me seeing, of all things, like how a sports team owner gets involved in.
It's just so petty.
The depths of Washington bureaucracy and corruption. Yeah, and super petty, and just like you know, the rich thinking the rules are different. It's a great example of that. Want to talk about term limits? That was brought up. You said you had some thoughts on term limits. Beto O'Rourke, congressman from Texas, running for Senate against Ted Cruz, and some others put forward a term limit, congressional term limit bill.
Yeah, that's a great idea, isn't it?
Yeah, my opinions have dampened a little bit on this issue over the years, but tell me yours.
Well, the problem with the bureaucracy is that people get into it, well, I guess not even bureaucracy, but elected positions, and they stay there for 30 years. I mean, don't get me wrong, you do learn things as a politician mm-hmm. and performing those functions, but the depth of your experience isn't comparable to being a private citizen. Like, for instance, if you were a professor instead of a senator, you would acquire more specialization, more knowledge, arguably a wider social network.
Yeah.
but being a senator, you do not. So, with, you know, the general entropy that everybody has to endure, the value of somebody being in a position for 30 years is necessarily deteriorated.
Yeah, that's interesting. It almost seems like there'd be, like, a bell to it. Like, a first-term congressman, second term, might know very little. Your knowledge might...
Right.
Not even a bell, but just, like, it jumps up at some point and then kind of levels.
Mm-hmm. Like, there's only so much you can go down about the government.
Maybe
yeah,
once you get to, like, 85 or something.
Feinstein.
What was that last point?
Oh, I was just calling out Feinstein.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot, especially Senate. I don't know. I guess I don't know as many congressmen, but, man, some of these senators are super old.
Yeah, and they've been there for 30 years, which is, you know, more to the point. Like, we need people with more relevance and newer experiences who are being affected by these policies to... You know, tell us what they think.
Yeah, so my cynical take about this... there's really no reason... I can't really think of a good reason to be against it, although I thought that the limits themselves might have been a tad short. I'd maybe make them a little bit longer if I were doing it. I think it was... essentially, they were trying to do 12 years for both Congress and Senate, if I recall.
Oh, so two terms for senators and six for the House of Representatives.
I think that's what it was.
That's not so bad.
I'd maybe err a little bit longer. I mean, yeah, 40 years is too much, you know, like some of these people have. 30 years, 20 years is, you know.
Like, Senator Byrd was in the Senate for, like, 50 years, right?
Yeah, you know, he became VP, but Biden was in the Senate at a young age. And, you know, I mean, he went up until 65, or I think he was in his 30s. I think he was there for, like, 30 years. And Jeez. Would probably still be if he hadn't been tapped as vice president for Obama. I mean, he was popular there. He wasn't going to stop, you know. So I don't really have a reason to be against it. But it strikes me that it's not the problem with Washington, whereas years ago I might have said it is, like, the problem. So I don't know if it would, like, be like...
Well, years ago it was the problem. Like, years ago we didn't have the money that is the problem now.
Oh, that's a good point. Yes, it's not so much that this problem got less, it's that a different thing became more of a problem. Yeah, that's interesting. There's probably something to that. The way I see it helping, though, is... Because you're pointing out how they're not really learning that much more, so you want fresh blood, which I think is a good point. To me, a way that it really helps is that they won't be trying to protect their own seats. They won't be doing things so that they remain a congressman or senator. Because they know it's only going to go on so long and there's nothing you can do about it.
I think there's a lot of value in that ability to make that kind of decision, though. Like, do you vote for what you know is right rather than what will get you elected?
Yeah, I agree. It's that, to me, is the biggest benefit of it. And, you know, on some level, you have to... you know, that may come into conflict with experience, you know, about the way government works, people in government, programs, you know. I mean, there can be a benefit to that too. And but yeah, I just think getting them to not protect their own safe position is the best benefit of it. Having more people involved is probably good, so as not to concentrate political power so much. I just have become a little skeptical as to how much we as average people would see the change. I think it would be noticeable, but maybe not as much as I used to think. That's all.
I think it would also kind of reduce the amount of money in politics, right? certainly reduce the constant campaigning, at least on some level.
Well, I mean, if you think about, you're looking at a senator who's in his second term,
mm-hmm.
can't be reelected.
6 years of not giving a fuck, though.
Did you see, I didn't really have anything more on Tim Rooms. Did you see, in Wisconsin, one of our favorite prior topics in Tell Me What to Think, Kevin Nicholson, who's running for the Republican primary to be senator to take out Tammy Baldwin, he made a comment at this speech recently where he's like, if need be, I'll pledge to only serve one term.
That's a strange statement.
Yeah, like, first of all, just pledge or don't pledge. like, ooh, I might only serve, like, you know, it's like kind of trying to like have your cake and eat it too. Like, you're not promising to do this thing, but you're putting it out there to probably get people to think you're like, oh, you know, so noble. But I heard a little bit of pushback that was like, actually, I think it was from a prior author we've talked about, Mike Duncan, who does the Revolutions podcast. He's like, so you're going to be a completely, like, inexperienced, useless politician for 6 years. Because he has no political experience, this guy, either. Like, he's never even been a...
What, Kevin Nicholson has never even...
No, he's a political consultant.
Oh, so he's politics adjacent, but has never actually been elected.
Yeah, correct. I mean, he's the guy who is, to remind people, been in the military, been a political consultant, quote-unquote, out of Chicago, I believe, and he's tied in with Uline and America's
there
PAC.
There it is.
America's PAC. I don't know. It just, historically, I'm reminded a little bit of, it's obviously way different. I believe Teddy Roosevelt made a promise like that and kept to it. So he became president when McKinley was assassinated, and he promised to only see...
Be elected once,
yeah,
right?
Get elected once. And I think he made that promise when he was running for that first election. He's like, hey, you know, I've already been president for most of this term. I'm seeking another term. I won't go again after that. Even though that was before the whatever amendment, so he could have actually gone multiple times, but... They still had that tradition of two terms. And he apparently regretted that promise.
Hmm. I mean, if he had just rolled into another term, he could have done what FDR did like 30 years earlier.
And so that would have, we wouldn't have had Taft, I believe. Taft would have never run against Teddy.
You don't think? No, probably not.
No. And then who knows how history would have changed after that. You never know.
Well, Taft might not have been the head of the Supreme Court, which is another interesting change.
I don't know much about him on the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
but that just gets to the last point that I wanted to bring up. Perfect. The Supreme Court overturned the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, which made it illegal for a state to legalize sports gambling, except for under certain circumstances. I am reading from something that our legal expert, Dave, sent us. I asked him for a little take on this. They struck down the laws unconstitutional under the anti-commandeering provision of the Constitution. It's viewed as a big thing for states' rights. But as he points out, there are already libertarians calling for a federal legalization of gambling, which would...
That seems contrary to a libertarian ideal, but...
Well, it's definitely... So he kind of, in this email he sent us, Dave points out, he uses the term, the Federalists in Libertarian Clothing, kind of delineating, I'm seeing this as, you know, those aren't totally overlapping ideas.
Well, no, it's the libertarians who try to, you know, say they're libertarian, but then use federal policy and regulation to get what they want.
Yeah. You know, go big or go home, I guess.
By any means necessary.
Yeah. So anyway, they are Some of them are calling for federal legalization of gambling because this... It's sort of like this was thrown out because of states' reasons, but then it's like, wouldn't the federal government legalizing it for all states also be unconstitutional? You know? Because, like, if the federal government saying one thing is unconstitutional because states have a right to make the rules, isn't the federal government saying the opposite thing also unconstitutional? Or is that, like, a complicated legal thing that I don't understand?
Yeah, it seems like it's two different questions. This might... because, like, as you said, pointed out, the Tenth Amendment says everything that's not reserved to the federal government should be, you know, pushed down to the state level, which would seem to include gambling. But I'd also like to mention Ginsburg's dissent against the individual prohibition, which is the idea that an individual prohibition on the individual against specific acts is in the best interests of our society and country, which, I don't know, legalized gambling seems to fit that pretty easily, right? Like, you could see there are moral... Well, I mean, maybe I don't necessarily agree, but some people would say there are moral implications to gambling that make it necessary to outlaw entirely, like on a national level.
Yeah.
But, yeah, apparently only one other Supreme Court justice agreed with her, as the vote was 7-2.
Yeah, as legal expert Dave points out, he doesn't quite understand Ginsburg's dissent, but she is way... But, quote, she is way smarter than me. All right, I just want to point that out. I thought it's it's Murphy versus NCAA. Seems like one of those Supreme Court rulings that will have a very practical effect on people's lives.
Sure. And with the NFL already advocating for federal regulation of gambling, well, this issue will develop relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Especially in the free-for-all regulatory environment that the Trump administration is cultivating.
Yeah. I just want to say about the NFL doing that, that seems like... That's just pure capitalism. That's just pure, we need to open up more markets for ourselves.
And they want to control the market.
Yeah. They're not the only one. I've heard the NBA commissioner also talking about gambling, legalizing it. I think part of it is they want to, like... So for the NFL, I don't know the specifics of what they have proposed, but I know some of the logic behind it is... they could run themselves, like fantasy football leagues and stuff for money. And, what were those one groups that were creating all that hubbub? Last year, I cannot remember what that was. Like, the state of New York made them illegal. They call them, daily fantasy or whatever.
Oh, yeah, the fantasy football that was too much like gambling for New York's...
Yeah, country. Whatever that one was. And so the NFL, I think, has the goal of putting, owning the means of those, and then they could spread that across the country with their, you know, marketing and everything, and reap all the profits like a casino. So, I mean...
Well, and there's trademarks, too, because, you know, if they... were regulated gambling purveyors, they would also have to negotiate use of the NFL's trademarks in their advertising and operations.
All right, so Jessica Jones on Netflix, season 2. Came out. I don't know when it came out, but I just heard about it this last week. And I raced through it because I want to talk about it. And I love Jessica Jones. I think out of the first seasons of all the shows, that or Luke Cage were my favorite.
Well, I mean, the first season of Jessica Jones sets up Luke Cage, so
Yeah.
True. It's tough to disentangle them.
It's actually kind of funny. So I was like, oh, sweet, second season two is out. So I go and I thought I turned it on. So I just click on Jessica Jones and press play on the account, or on the computer. And I start watching it, and I'm like, oh, she's watching Luke Cage. And I get like 10 minutes in, and I'm like, holy shit, I'm just watching the first episode again. Like of season one. Took me a while to get into to realize. Because it kind of just jumps right into her being a PI in that first season.
Mm-hmm.
So
no setup.
Yeah.
Which I kind of like.
Yeah. It actually probably goes into... No, it definitely goes into more of her origin in season two than it did in season one.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you barely even understand who Jessica Jones is in the first season, other than, like, how she acts and, you know, the kind of role that she's carved out for herself.
Mm-hmm. Kind of regardless of being superpowered, almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the superpower is incidental to, you know, her being an investigator.
Yeah, she, in general, one thing I like about her is that she's kind of that, even though she has a superpower, she kind of reminds me of Batman in that her skills are, you know, she's a detective, she's smart, she's wily.
She's great at social engineering. Holy cow.
Planning. Yeah, she's more interesting than her powers. So, I don't know, how did you like it in general, season two?
It was kind of focused more on character growth, which mm-hmm. I appreciate, and, you know, because it makes it for a better narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, the decisions that people make in the second season. Like, a couple of key characters are put in, like, shall we say, difficult or challenging moments, and so often they're just like, yep, I'm going the wrong way.
Yep. I didn't say this at the beginning, but we're trying to do this conversation spoiler-free.
Sorry.
No, you were fine. You were fine. I just sort of reminding myself as I respond. It specifically the idea of taking a life, without saying whose lives get taken or who takes lives in the show. But that's, like, a huge theme. Which is, like, kind of like, to me, like, great. It's been done a lot in comics, but it's, like, a classic comic book superhero storytelling because it only makes sense. You have, essentially, if you have a superpower, you have a huge weapon.
Yeah, it's like it's like not even walking around with a like a some kind of like pistol or rifle because those require loading and chemical interactions. And your Jessica Jones can just flick a finger and literally kill someone.
Yeah, and so I appreciate that kind of baseline storytelling because. To be honest, it hasn't really been done in, I'm trying to think, at all in the MCU. I mean, maybe a little bit here and there, but in general, there isn't a character, a protagonist, that has grappled with it as much. You know, they have this power. What's okay to do with it? What's not? Should I take a life? And then there's kind of other characters in the narrative. It's not just Jessica Jones.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people have to...
Almost all of them, yeah. Actually are grappling with that question, actually.
And I think, well, perhaps the other main question in the show is, what are you willing to do to get power?
Yes.
Which is a fascinating question. Fascinating look at various characters and how they deal with it.
Yeah, it's not just to get power, but it's sort of like just that general means versus ends. Because it's also like, what's okay to do if your view is to help the world? And you're not a complete maniac, you're not like, it's not like Hitler, where it's like, well, I'm just helping the world, and I just happen to have to kill 12 million people. It's not like a ridiculous... Sure. You know, means versus ends. it's a little bit more reasonable for some of the characters. And I think the taking a life is fits into that means versus ends.
Yeah. I think it's in some ways a better season because it wasn't just about chasing one villain. Exactly.
Yes. In fact, it's hard to exactly pinpoint what and who the villain is.
Jessica Jones. No, I kid. She's not the villain.
It's not as cut and dry as like she's not going up against the hand, you know?
Right. An objectively evil group.
Yeah. It's very different than I would say every and Netflix MCU show so far, or season so far. To me the other theme, but I think it's less in this season than the first season, is feminism, femininity, roles of women. In the first season, I think, because you had that mind-controlling man.
The Purple Man.
The Purple Man. It was a very clear theme, whereas in this one, I think it was more like a quote here, a quote there. It wasn't... The main narrative wasn't a commentary on that theme as much.
Hmm. It's kind of like the issue of control, isn't it?
It's a what?
It's the issue of control in feminism.
Yeah.
Like, in the first season, it was her control was completely subverted by somebody who could literally control her mind, and now, in the second season, she has control, she's forced to explore it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There were some cool scenes. One I took a note on here as I was watching it, without really giving a spoiler as to why she's there. But she's on a, golf course, and she just kind of has like this antipathy towards the patriarchy. Like, I think she makes some sort of comment like, "Oh, there's just a bunch of rich assholes here," or something like that. And the club itself was an all men's club, golf club, country club. And like, there were little bits like that. There's some character that makes reference to them being, talks about, like, powerful women and what powerful women should do. And resentment at husbands and stuff like that. But they were usually kind of just character-building moments, more so than, I thought, like, plot moments.
Yeah. I give it a 2 thumbs up. That was a great show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I in general like the Netflix shows. Luke Cage is coming out soon. Mm-hmm. Season 2 of Luke Cage. To get into the broader MCU, one little nerdy thing I want to mention is that I think this was one of the most explicit ways that it was put into the greater MCU in this show, from the Netflix shows, and it's that that one character kid asks Jessica Jones if she knows Captain America, because I believe they haven't said those characters' names. I was reading something about it recently. Like, they have it, they'll say, like, the guy with the hammer or something like that instead of Thor.
Yeah, and they referenced the disaster in New York a couple times. But
in the very first Daredevil, I think they do, right?
Yeah, and in The Defenders.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's been in the MCU, but to me that was, like, one of the most clear examples. I kind of wish it would be more, not so much, like, the Defenders show up in Avengers 4 or anything like that, but
man, at least a cameo.
Like, one thing I think I heard brought up about something to do with Netflix, I don't remember what, but something to do with Netflix shows is, why aren't the Sokovia Accords talked about in the Netflix shows? like that should be.
Because they all live in New York, and New York is a cultural bubble that doesn't care about anything but itself.
Yeah, that might be the reason, actually. They just don't stick out enough in New York, I guess. Okay, yeah, that was about all I had to say about it. Oh, and fucking in a pool of paint is weird. That was my last note.
Weird and impractical.
It just, I didn't like anything. Oh, actually, I do have one more note here, which is a kind of general theme for this or the first season. Jessica Jones made me realize that I like emotionally distant, badass, stoic, self-destructive, lone wolf private investigators, regardless of gender.
Mm.
It hasn't been done enough females that are in that role. I think it's generally viewed as a cliche male role. And I like her as much as I've liked Jack Nicholson in Chinatown or, you know, whatever other private investigator.
It's an interesting kind of misogynistic point you made, like how men are allowed to have that remove or that distance, but women mm-hmm. typically aren't.
Yep. I mean, that's, to me, that's, in the first season of the show, that, like, was the most striking thing to me, actually. Was like, I've known more people like, not to her extreme, but I've known more women like that in real life than I've seen shown on screen. You know? Like,
oh, yeah.
It's more realistic than Hollywood portrays. And again, exaggerated for TV in this case, but.
Well, I mean, the exaggeration in TV always. Skews towards like women being the mothers, housekeepers, like the cornerstone of society. But it's like not every woman wants to get married, and certainly maybe not most, but a lot of women don't want to have children.
Yeah, and it's interesting that she shows she has empathy, so she's not so much. And I don't know if I'm talking about the character or the writers. Doesn't really matter. She has empathy, clearly, but she shuns her empathy sometimes, but it's not a complete rejection of, like, that aspect of kind of cliche femininity in terms of, like we're used to seeing female characters with all this empathy for other characters and things. I mean, she does have it, but she also, like, tries to drink it away. And I don't know, it's just, I just find it interesting, but she kind of has like, you know, she has an independent streak, which is unfortunately refreshing. Yeah, I don't know. I would not call this film noir, but it has a lot of the similar character elements to film noir. I think that the genre can work as well with women as men, which. It's one of those things that's like, doesn't have to be said, but kind of does have to be said.
Apparently.
Yeah, exactly. This past week, there was an article on 538.com by Perry Bacon Jr., titled Why Obama versus Trump is Such a Blowout. I have not read this article, and I don't think you have either. But
yeah, you couldn't get past the illustration.
Yeah, so right, almost like just a few sentences in, there's an image that has a, I guess you'd call it a visual model of politics, and it's supposed to be placed
weird
in.
Weird visualization, though.
What?
It's a kind of a weird visualization. They're trying for a two-axis thing, but one of their axes doesn't make any sense.
So, I'm looking at it again, too. Actually, I didn't even see. Anyway, so it has an economic axis,
and a social access. Am I reading
as
that
if
right?
They could, yeah, as if they could be so easily pieced apart.
And they have essentially four, well, five if you include the middle, groups that they label. The lowest economic and social percentages, which i.e. more government intervention in social and more government intervention in economic, I guess, is populist. The opposite of that would be libertarian. The less government intervention economics, but still in social, would be right conservative, and then the opposite of that is left conservative, and then there's just a square in the middle with moderate, and it says Joe Manchin. Which, I don't think we would have a disagreement with him being placed there, actually.
I mean, kind of.
Well, get into it.
Yeah.
Have okay. at it.
Well, the problem with this that I see is, like, it contrasts liberalism and populism. Or, not liberalism, but libertarianism and populism, mm-hmm. yeah. which isn't exactly... Okay, there are two different relationships that they're trying to, like, piece together here. The relationship between the government and the state, or the government and society, and the government and the individual, which aren't exactly contrary to each other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the part that I wanted to point out was Bernie Sanders' position as being... what was it? More libertarian, or was he marked as more populist?
He is slightly... So he is all the way to the left on social, which means less government intervention in social things, whatever that means.
But that makes no sense with his economic policies.
Well, no, that means he's also more government intervention with economic policies.
Okay, well,
and he's, which, but the way they define things makes him just a literally like it looks like just a hair more libertarian than populist. Pretty much in the middle, they have him.
Hmm. Which, again, these are two different relationships that they're trying to piece out. Like, really, they should be showing some kind of matrix, perhaps. Like. Because mm-hmm. trying to label people with these, like, broad political terms which don't necessarily have concise meanings, like populist and libertarian, mm-hmm. is incredibly problematic.
Yeah. I mean, populist is... It's such a... It has a definition, but I find it really hard to peg most American politicians squarely as populists.
Right. Viktor Orban in Hungary is more of a populist than, well, anyone we have in our current society or makeup.
Yeah. I mean, it has, like, Chuck Schumer as... So the trouble I have is that maybe we're reading this wrong in that maybe this doesn't mean Bernie Sanders is more libertarian because he's not in the libertarian square. It just means he's more of or less of whatever on the social and economic axis. Because who would call Chuck Schumer more of a populist? Like, it doesn't...
That makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense. So then... But he is... So this would be saying he is...
Yeah, the guy who embraces Trump's decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem is not a populist.
He is... I don't know. I mean, I just have a fundamental issue with this whole thing, which is, we could probably spend a bunch of time making a better graph, I guess.
Sure.
Maybe it has a third axis, maybe we're redefining the terms, I don't know.
I don't think I would ever use a graph like this. Like, maybe a score sheet, like, for instance, this is how this person rates on NSA abuses, or, you know, NSA prep. Programs. This is how this person rates on 10th Amendment issues or 2A or Second Amendment issues. Like, there's so you could basically go amendment by amendment and get their opinion because, there are barely even cohesive party platforms anymore.
Well, and that that's more like if you were a voter trying to vote, you know, which Senate candidate should I vote for, that's more like what you're describing, what you would use for, like, this is a priority issue for me, this one isn't, you know, he or she agrees with me a lot here, not so much, you know. You'd kind of go over the few issues that are important to you that are big issues in that campaign or whatever. No one would really... Maybe I have two fundamental issues with what's going on here. So, no one would really use this image here to help them pick candidates. Like, you wouldn't define where you are on it and then look at a dot and be like, all right, Nancy Pelosi's with me here. Or whoever. Because it's just, it's so simplistic and it's like, it's not even talking about issues. But the thing is that the problem I have with, I mean, I read a little bit of the article, I did not read the whole thing, but is that they are using this to talk about differences in the popularity of a candidate. And I believe the premise for putting this image in is that look how similar these two candidates are, and I think they're talking about Barack and Hillary, yet their popularities are so different. And their point being that it's not really about positions.
What? Okay.
But, which, yeah, like, which in and of itself, that conclusion about Obama and Clinton may or may not be true. I don't really care.
Yeah,
but,
not really important.
But the idea then is that they're then making conclusions about voters using this paradigm that they're modeling here. But no voter would use this paradigm to vote or pick candidates. It's like they're trying to define voters using this, but no voter would use this to define candidates. Like, it only notionally works one way, but I would argue it doesn't work either way, either direction.
Yeah, so this whole article is just seemingly a... This person came up with a model and is trying to demonstrate how valuable it is to...
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, there might be, like, other bits in here that are more... I mean, there's some other... I don't know. There's a couple balloting things down below. I mean, that might be something worthwhile. I don't know. My other issue, though, with this whole... The whole concept of this graphical modeling is... Politician, so like it's one thing to talk about, and what you were describing, by the way, going issue by issue, is a fine way to handle this. But politicians don't purely vote their ideology, even if their ideology is complicated and nuanced. They don't like, I'm not even saying anything like totally like anti-politician or surprising when I say this, but they make deals, you know? Like, if a person votes for a bill, that doesn't mean everything in there is their favorite thing, their ideal thing.
Right, how people love to paint Bernie as being an NRA supporter when he's in fact not.
Yeah, or even, like... You know, we don't... Some of the times, these politicians might even vote for bills that aren't even over 50% what they think. You know? We don't know what's happening behind closed doors. We don't know if there was exchanges of votes. Because, so, not just deal-making within a bill, but deal-making between bills. Oh, right. I'll support the banking bill if you support the military.
Immigration reform.
Yeah. And then, obviously, it's happening within the bill, too, which is why bills are, you know, bloated and have a lot of things going on in them. They don't... There's, like, almost no such thing, right, as, like, a single-issue bill anymore.
Almost not. They are. Like, I would say it's increasingly singular. Like, bills are much less complicated than they were even a few years ago.
Well, there's less of, like, the, what do they call that? The, like, pork spending and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Although they're trying to bring that back, a bunch of them. I think that was a topic we didn't talk about a couple months ago, actually, that I forgot to bring up, was certain congressmen were trying to get back more, what is that called, like appropriations spending or whatever?
Right, their special projects, what is it called? Yeah.
Yeah, because that was actually one thing that I think I agree with. So there's actually interesting arguments for it. In that, essentially, the main argument is as a representative of this district, I can help my people with this thing, which most people would say is a good thing. It just doesn't affect most people.
Sure. I can understand why a local official would have a maybe not a necessarily a better idea, but an idea of what to do locally.
Yeah. And
like which program to support.
And the pitfalls of it are obvious in that it leads to improper spending. Sometimes it can lead to more local, hard-to-detect corruption, more quid pro quos. There's a lot of reasons it's for and against it, that whatever. But that is one of the things that Paul Ryan actually did as Speaker, I believe. Him and or Boehner was to...
I think that was Boehner, right? That was before Ryan came in.
But Ryan might have been the Ways and Means chairman at the time, so he would have had a role in reforming spending practices, I believe. But whatever. We shouldn't spend too much time trying to search out a compliment for Paul Ryan.
Yeah.
So anyways, anything more you want to say about the... I just think the whole notion is flawed. I mean, if you look at this, like, Donald Trump's just, like, in the middle of right-conservative, whereas if you went issue by issue, he'd be, like, this up-and-down crazy line.
Yeah, he'd be, like, a weird outlier in the rest of the Republicans. They at least are usually consistent in their ideology.
Yeah, this almost makes him seem like he's just a normal, everyday Republican if you just looked at this.
Which, you know, kind of reveals the flaws in graphical representations.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no corruption axis? That seems to be, like, one of the most important distinguishing marks in politics these days.
Yes.
And, well, you know, I guess...
That would be hard to quantify.
Well, no, it'd be easy to quantify in just a dollar amount.
Like how much they...
Yeah, how much PACs have spent to support you and how much you've taken in. And what, you know, what your median donation is.
That would be it. Like a little topographical map of...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I like that idea. So, I don't know. Anything more you want to say about...
Well, I hope people... Oh, I just wish voter... Or I really not wish, but perhaps hope people spend more time on thinking about politics and trying to, you know, use, like, one or two axes representations which have very little relationship to reality to determine who they're going to vote for.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of, So... Notionally, this graph is supposed to be taking in lots of different stances and issues and whatever. But it kind of reminds me of, like, one-issue voting, litmus test voting, where it's like, well, is he pro-gun or anti-gun? Is he pro-choice or pro-life?
I mean, that might actually be an interesting matrix. Like, if there were three decisions, like, for or against repealing Citizens United, for or against... universal health care, and what's the third one? Oh yeah, endless war. Those would be at least three issues that, you know, you could really learn something about how somebody feels if you know the answers to those questions.
Yeah, but it still is.
Yeah, it's just a little.
Yeah, I mean, because that would be, and that's fine for, like, if that's the way, like, those are your priorities. But it's. It's just, like, your opinion, man. No,
I guess that is my opinion.
It still just simplifies... Because this graph here is supposed to be not even so much predictive as reflective of who they are supposed to be. What they have voted for, what they have supported. Not so much trying to predict what they'll vote on in the future. And so...
But that kind of gives the lie to the whole package. Like, if it were based on previous votes, I mean, you could look at the 2006 bankruptcy bill and, like, very clearly delineate some of those people. I think... But it goes to me, like, it just... It looks like somebody put their dots on just because of how they feel about individual candidates and their perspectives.
Yeah, and even if they actually had a lot of data points in here, it almost seems like the data points might have been skewed to get them to show up at a certain point in the axis.
Right, to get Hillary and Bernie in the same room as each other.
Yeah. Like, maybe not waiting. Like, okay, like, certain pieces of legislation, certain issues are more important, are more... even if they're on the same issue, some of them have greater effects than others. So maybe if I'm some politician who is going to kind of vote pro-bank on this one bill and sort of anti-bank, you know, kind of pro-consumer on another one, maybe it's because the magnitudes of these bills are much different. Like this one, okay, this one I'm willing to trade. It's a harmless thing, more or less. I'm willing to trade this for a vote somewhere else. But this one over here, this is game-changing for the entire country, and I can't.
Right, it's the difference between modifying a regulation and making a rule.
All right, I want to get into a number of Wisconsin-related things, but first, let's talk about this. It's actually was in The Nation. So there's an article they put out, "Progressives Need a New Way to Talk About National Security." Byline, "Voters say they support cuts in defense spending. Democrats should too." This, we both thought, reflected some thoughts you've had recently on the podcast to me it seemed a lot like a progressive, it's more specifically about national security and military spending, but it really related to this progressive foreign policy we talked about, I thought.
Sure. Because, you have to. Our foreign policy primarily is defense spending anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That's maybe even been that way for a while. It's hard to tell. Anyways, so these guys commit. Let me get their names here to give them credit. Joe Cirincione and Guy T. Saperstein. That sounds fake. No offense to Guy. Guy T. Saperstein. Love that name. they commissioned a poll, and they kind of tried some national security questions, but then they sort of reframed them and trying to get an idea of what voters think about defense spending and broadly speaking. And their findings, I think to really do this comprehensively, you need multiple polls done different ways and all that. But their findings give some credence to the idea that the American people are not as pro-war as some would have you believe, and aren't as for more military spending as our Congress and Senate would have you believe. So I don't know, what were your thoughts about this? Just like, yeah, I was right.
I mean, yeah, I was right. I mean, I can't help but think about how being even just slightly anti-war gave Donald Trump just a huge electoral victory.
Oh, for sure. Hey, and look at Barack Obama campaigned as anti-war.
I mean, he gave a lie to that with his 2007 NDAA vote, right?
Yeah, but that's not how he was campaigning.
Yeah.
And even look at W. So, I mean, W campaigned as, like, I'm the tough Republican, sure, but it was, we're not going to nation build anymore. We're not the policemen of the world.
But to contradict with that, he also he didn't exactly say it, but he signaled throughout the campaign that he was going to invade Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely made Saddam Hussein out to be a boogeyman, but I don't know, man. Like, I remember, like, he was campaigning against, wasn't he campaigning against, like, bombing the world, you know, like Clinton's, oh, he's just bombing all these random places, and we spend all this money trying to fix these countries.
No, his problem was the humanitarian aspect of it. He didn't think the military should give that much of a concern or regard about the people. I mean, because...
I think we can fairly say that except for some comments that Trump has made, because there are definitely some super pro-war things he said in the campaign.
Oh, yeah, like advocating the return of waterboarding and worse.
Bombing
like
the shit out of them. Families. I mean, he talked about bombing the shit out of them and killing their families and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, yes, you're right. When he kind of talked about certain countries, he's like, I was against the war in Iraq. I think we should, you know, don't vote for Hillary. She'll expand the war in Syria. You know, like, why are we even in Afghanistan? Things like that. And I think you're right. I mean, I think that spoke to more people, including, like, people on the far right, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're the, like, xenophobic isolationists, so you can understand that. At least that's some... There's some ideological consistency there, even if you don't necessarily agree with it. You can understand. Mm-hmm. You know where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, I would say we have not really had a super hawk campaign as a... Someone's campaign as a big-time hawk win the presidency, win a national election... Since Reagan, kind of, even though Reagan actually didn't govern as a super hawk.
Yeah, Reagan even campaigned as a kind of a peace candidate.
Like, well, yeah.
Not the big government guy.
Yeah, yes. I mean, who... Is anyone... I mean...
Has anyone actually run on peace? Maybe Carter, but not convincingly.
Well, I mean, has anyone run on just straight-up war, though? Like, as... like. Nixon, maybe? I mean, even Nixon was about, like, don't they often say, like, I'll bring peace? I might have to do it with some war, but I'll bring peace.
Yeah, and Nixon was like, I'll get us out of Vietnam, and fuck if he didn't.
Like, surprise, surprise, peace seems to be a winning campaign strategy. To some degree.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, funny. Yeah, I was right. Pat myself on the back there.
Okay. So anyways, interesting article. I think we suggest reading it. So let's move on to some Wisconsin stuff going on here. You want to talk about this rural Wisconsin article from WisContext?
Well, yeah, I just want to kind of point out that a lot of the places in Wisconsin that we think of as rural are very much not rural. Like, for instance, Rock County, even though our population centers aren't exactly the largest in the state, their proximity to Rockford even further south kind of makes this one of the metropolitan or megalopolises that are developing in the United States. Because, I don't know when the last time you've been to the space between Beloit and Janesville, but it is not like it was even 10 years ago. There's, mm-hmm. like, almost no distinguishable difference. There's almost continuous development up County Road G and Highway 51.
So,
And then you have, like, the Lake Winnebago... Or the Winnebago Valley, which is kind of in a similar place.
So what's the, like, thesis of this article? Is it just saying Wisconsin isn't as rural as you might think?
Yes. And, it's kind of giving a definition to what demographers consider rural and urban.
Okay. And so, is that... Why do we... Why might people think that it... Is it just because these aren't rigorously defined to the common man? Or is it something like, there's like... even if you don't live in New York City, there's almost like this metropolis bias in our minds?
Yeah, like you don't want to be urban, but... You are absolutely in an urban space. It's kind of an ideological divide, right? You want to... Mm-hmm. People want to be rural and from small towns, but... Yeah.
I mean,
It's an interesting way of framing interests and... Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, like, I grew up... So, not in the city of Racine, but just outside in Mount Pleasant, farmland, although a lot of that's turned into subdivision since then, and some of it's going to be turned into Foxconn very soon. I mean, a lot of farmland around where I live, but I've always considered myself a city kid. I wasn't raised in the city, like, on a urban block where, like, you know, you run around on the streets all day and night, but I assume that's what kids in the city do, right? There wasn't a playground down the block from me, nothing like that. But I've always considered myself a city kid because I've always been like, I am not a country kid. Like, I mean,
like
I guess...
you've never milked a cow?
There's the... Yeah, I don't know anything. I don't... Like, you know, I didn't grow up on, like, acres of land. I didn't... You know, we, like, we have a mutual friend who's from, kind of central of the state here. You know, grew up on a farm. I mean, just... Even yeah, beyond, like, his immediate real. Land that he grew up on, just, like, how small the school is, how far you have to drive to get to a store or a restaurant, things like that, totally different than I've ever lived in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even there, like, the... It kind of... This megalopolis issue, like, the town that I grew up in is a lot like his. It was super small. We had FFA week where the farmers brought their tractors and their animals in. But it's still urban, according to the definition, because it's only a stone's throw away from Beloit.
Yes. I mean, to me, that's like... Yeah, that's... That, you know, there's areas of the country and state, Wisconsin, that you can... I mean, if you look at this map that's in this Wisconsin... You know, look at a couple of these counties don't have anything that's listed on here in terms of even, what do they call it, micro areas or whatever. And yeah, are even, East like, County a couple North. Counties away from much.
Yeah. It's, like, really, really underdeveloped in areas in the Northwood.
Yeah. And, you know, or, like, we have, like, where my family goes for our vacation up in the UP, you know, you're an hour and a half away from, like, a hospital. You know, if you're under 15 minutes away from a hospital, I don't know if you're that rural. Even if there's a bunch of farmers around you.
Sure. Even if you, yeah. Even if, like, the mile around you is perfectly pristine, you're still in the urban area.
Yeah.
Because you still have access to those urban resources.
Exactly. What's next for Wisconsin? The child tax rebate is happening. So a while back, our Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin here, through his legislature, or not his legislature, you know, the legislature, passed a... And I think, if I recall at the time, a lot of the Republicans in the Congress were like, well, why? What the fuck is this going to do? Can't we do other things that are way better for the taxpayers? And Walker was pretty dead set on this, which is a child tax rebate. It's $100 per person who paid for a minor dependent in 2017. $100 per dependent.
Is that child dependent or adult dependent?
It's called the child tax rebate, so I'm pretty sure it's just child.
But you can see, like, having some, like, a disabled adult dependent, right?
Maybe that's why. So my problem with this, and then maybe this will explain why they have to do it this way, actually. Maybe there is a reasonable explanation. I don't know. My problem with it is that you have to, so there's, like, a 2-week opening, which starts, if not today, very soon, next couple days, to sign up for this. It was viewed at the time, and I'm viewing it this way now, that kind of just a bribe to voters in the state, because Walker is up for re-election in the fall, and he's paying, he views it as, oh, I'm going to pay $100 per kid. To me, this squarely seems aimed at middle-class voters. It's people with families, with kids. It's people who are paying attention to the news to know this thing exists and will sign up for it in this short 2-week window. Have internet access, I believe you need to sign up for it. Or if not, it's certainly much easier with internet access. It does not seem just a blanket way to help. Like, to me, things like this should help poorer people. I mean, right?
Sure, right? If you're gonna... This is kind of like a hugely populist thing.
Yeah. And, so, anyway, I just... It strikes me as classist. It strikes me as pathetic. strikes me as...
certainly coded, right? I mean, and it's like the difference between, like, oh, educated people don't have as many kids, but Christians, especially in the Quiverful movement, have as many as they possibly can.
Yeah, it's clearly not just going for... Because I think that's what some of the other Republicans were going towards. It's like, we can just, like, do a little tax rebate for everyone, or do a little tax, you know, cut in some way, shape, or form, you know, a broader one. But he was really pointing at the kids thing. There's also going to be a sales tax holiday coming up that's also part of this.
Wait, isn't there one usually in August every year for kids' school supplies?
Oh, is that all it is? So there's usually one of those?
Yeah, there's usually one of those. Like, I know he's done that at least a couple of times in, like, the first... Is it the month of August, or, like, the
is it just for school July, supplies?
The first 2 weeks of Trump... Yeah.
So, okay. Yes, you're right, it is a back-to-school. He uses veto to extend sales tax holiday.
I mean, another aspect I'd like to bring up...
Yeah, you're right. Go ahead.
...is that this is a stupid, stupid way of trying to overcome Wisconsin's demographic problem. Like, right now, instead of being a bell curve, our demographic curve is a straight pillar because the older people and the younger people are aren't here as in the proportions that they should be. Because young people are leaving
the state. Older people move to Florida and Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Young people just move out as soon as they can.
Yeah.
Like, typically, how many people just don't even consider going to a Wisconsin school because they want to leave our beloved state?
Well, or almost worse, they do go to a good Wisconsin school and then move.
Yeah.
I've known many people, like, many people who have done that.
Yeah, and in some way I could see it as a way of trying to keep people from moving to Chicago, but... You'd have to do a little bit better than $100 a kid.
Well, yeah.
I mean, if it were a recurring tax rebate, then it would at least be a policy, but this is just a electoral ploy.
Yeah, it's very clearly an electoral ploy. It's... I don't really get... I mean, so let's even say it was a recurring thing. I don't even know how that's really... I don't know. I mean, $100, I don't want to scoff at it, but it's not changing anyone's life.
Yeah. It gives them, like, you know, those serotonins or endorphins, whatever you want to call it, like that quick feel-good moment, but... I mean, I guess you can pay for your Costco membership? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess something like that. I don't know. I'm not terrible.
I don't think it was very well thought through, but I think that about most everything Scott Walker does.
Well, and then let's move on to our final topic, the Department of Transportation. Well, that is the best segue, so we will move to the Department of Transportation for the sake of a good segue. His former head of the Department of Transportation has been a little vocal lately about Scott Walker not thinking things through very much. going back on his own policies that he campaigned on when it comes to our roads. Charles, can you give a little summary of why roads are so important in Wisconsin? Maybe more so than some other places?
Well, Wisconsin is kind of unique historically because if you look at, like, Nebraska and Iowa, we're one of the few states that, other than, like, you know, main city roads and, like, interstates, we have paved roads across almost the entire state because our rural industries have required them. Like, milk trucks have to go to the farms almost every day to get the product. Logging trucks can't drive on dirt roads as easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are incredibly important to our state economy.
And we have a lot of cold and snow, which is bad for roads.
Right.
Paved roads.
And so they require a lot of upkeep, too.
Yes. And so the former head of the Department of Transportation here is Mark Gottlieb. probably Gottlieb. That's the German in me coming out. He was the head of the DOT for 6 years. He, I guess, was a Republican.
He's a former mayor and served in the assembly for 8 years.
And then he worked in transportation, what was it, engineering or administration or something like that for a while.
He's an engineer.
Transportation engineer by trade, from Port Washington. And he has been kind of pissed at Walker recently. I think we might have talked about this a little bit when we talked about Foxconn before, and maybe I was complaining about the Beltline here in Madison, but it strikes me that the Walker administration is intentionally letting the roads in more Democratic-leaning areas, namely the two biggest cities in the state, or the highways, I should say, crumble and get destroyed. And he's not putting money in to fix them. It said something like they spent $9 million on the Beltline in Madison on studies to see what should be done, and then they're just like, yeah, but we're not going to do anything. And,
holy corruption, Batman.
Yeah, who got that $9 million? I don't know. Walker's been vocal about, like, we're not going to spend a cent in Milwaukee, even though they are finishing the current, they call it the zoo interchange there.
Right, because that's for the WOW counties. It benefits the commuters more than it does the people in the city.
Yeah, that's an important point. That is a big, it affects suburban areas, yes. Mm-hmm. Although he did say things like, we're not going to spend any more money, period, or something like that, in southeastern Wisconsin. He said that broadly. But you're right. His actions do point more towards what I'm saying, which is hurting the cities that didn't vote for him and won't vote for him, and helping the areas that would.
Right. And I think it reaches all the way down to like places like Rock County and Beloit, and specifically.
Mm-hmm. The I-90, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were, they had a big announcement, and they are going to do it. It said in the article, it is still being done. But isn't it, like, going slower than it was originally supposed to or something?
Yeah, the third lane was already supposed to be done by now. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with it, but it was at least some transportation infrastructure that they could improve.
I think I could be wrong on this, maybe someone can correct me. I think it was supposed to be a much bigger project when they first announced it, and then it kind of got scaled down.
Mm-hmm. They were going to go all the way to the Dells with three lanes.
Yeah. And a couple more points to make is that they fast-tracked a bunch of transportation spending for Racine, where Foxconn plant is going, because they had to do that for that Foxconn plant. And that they were able to do, and they took money from projects around the state, so the idea is now these things around the state will go a little slower. I have a feeling if you deep dived into which projects they took money from, it'll be I-90, Milwaukee,
probably Highway 51, other state highways.
They're pushing money into Racine for the Foxconn thing, you know, Paul Ryan and whatever is going on there. And so the big problem is that they are refusing to raise taxes that go towards transportation.
Yeah, specifically the gasoline tax, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, in general, fits with, a lot of Republicans, but Walker's thing of being irresponsible about money but refusing to raise taxes. That's mostly what he campaigns on.
Democrats, yeah, I thought fiscally conservative just meant you like to balance your budgets. It seemingly has morphed into trying to take as much money out of the government as you can.
So what really stuck out with me in this article is it's not just that, okay, he's not raising taxes, he's spending less on roads than he should be, and the roads might be being damaged. Okay, fine. That's not good, that's terrible. But, okay. But it's actually worse than that, because what money he is spending, apparently, is a lot of it being borrowed. So he's still spending on roads beyond their means, beyond their revenue. Like, he's still doing the bad thing.
That's like the opposite of fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. It's, yeah.
I mean, on some level, there's an economic argument to be made there. Like, improving the roads leads to more economic activity and higher state revenues, but at a certain point, that breaks down because you have to consider financing costs.
Well, yeah, I mean, I couldn't help but think when I was reading this article. Well, let's give a shout out to, by the way, before I get too far. It's from the Cap Times. Former DOT head is Scott Walker's chief critic on transportation by Caitlin Farrell. Farrell, I don't know, F-E-R-R-A-L. I couldn't help but think during this how some of these things would be way less relevant if they just would have done the fucking train in 2010.
Right? So much of this would be less, so much less relevant.
I mean, take longer to do the zoo interchange, fine. Don't fix I-94 as much. It'll have way less traffic on it.
Right? Let's have a train all the way to Chicago.
You know,
let's give people the option to not have to drive their car and put more carbon into the atmosphere.
Yeah, you would have, you know, you maybe could have raised the gas tax without people being as pissed about it if a certain percentage less were driving because they had access to this train.
Right? I mean, just, like, on a micro level, they could have used it as a commuter train in Madison if they just had, like, four stops across the city area, right?
Yeah, I don't remember. It was supposed to come downtown, but I don't really remember where it was coming into the city and going out.
Yeah, it was going to go through basically past Monona Terrace on those tracks.
Oh. Like, coming in from the south?
It kind of goes, it comes in along Lake, what is that, Monona?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it would basically go in the her former backyard across Madison to the east.
That would have been cool.
Yeah, right?
That's about when we were living there, too. Roughly. I don't know. Just want to point out Scott Walker's more of his many flaws and mismanagement of our state. And, you know, hey, let's go back to a little bit of like a populism thing. To me, regardless of bigger pictures of what you view about environmentalism and business and commerce, having good roads is a populist thing.
Right, because everybody has to drive on the roads unless you have a private helicopter.
I mean, yeah. How often do you... And multiple, it's not just, like, you know, a lower-class populist thing. Yeah, it's everyone. It's pretty much almost everyone.
Like, even the limos have to drive on the roads.
Yeah, or you have... maybe you're a business owner that has a fleet of trucks, and your trucks are getting beaten the shit up because the roads suck so much. I can't drive on this west belt line here. It's like the middle lane is just fucking tears up my car, so I have to either get in the slow lane or the fast lane. And like I deal with that like every day. And there's like potholes on a bunch of roads in Madison now. I'm not talking about like city roads. I'm talking about highways.
It's like, yeah, like 43 between Beloit and Milwaukee is just terrible.
Just mismanaging the state. And I think a big reason he got elected is because the previous governor took money out of the transportation fund to what balanced the state budget. Wasn't that what Doyle did?
Yeah.
And that was like a mortal sin to these people. But they're fine with shitty roads.
And like terrible funding schemes for them.
Yeah.
Like, just increase the gas tax. Like, we haven't had a gas tax increase since before Doyle, so maybe think about that a little.
I think I don't know if he straight up promised not to, but I have a feeling that's... I think he campaigned, if I recall, Walker's like, I will make up for the money taken out of the transportation fund without increasing the gas tax. But he really hasn't exactly done that. He maybe
I will reach into like this hat and pull out magical funding.
Yeah, the loosest definition of that promise he's kept, I guess. But he hasn't really, I don't know.
This just goes to highlight that he's only campaigning for, like, what, three different counties in the state, and everybody who happens to agree with those counties gets to go along with it.
So who's he, Waukesha?
The Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington County area, the WOW counties, mm-hmm. west of Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you don't live
Fox
in those
Valley,
areas...
somehow? Is Fox Valley factored in here?
Well, I mean, it's... I would say it's like one of those tangential places that they kind of get to go along because they're also kind of conservative and agree with the same points, but
I think their roads, really... their roads have been fixed up there within the past 5 years.
Oh, well, maybe he's also appealing to them.
Well, so. I'm saying it's not their problem anymore.
Oh, right, right. Oh, and there's the interstate that they put up between Milwaukee and the Fox Valley. It's in the last few years. What's the name of that road? Or the number of it?
I thought they did that a while ago.
Eh,
yeah, you're probably right. But I know, like, last few times I've gone to, like, Door County and gone through Green Bay and whatnot, they had a shit ton of construction. They might just be finishing it up now, or might be even done. But they really did a lot on the interstates up there and the highways. And a little bit before that, they were doing, it's like Oshkosh, or... What is it, like Oshkosh or Fond du Lac to Appleton? That was redone maybe 5-6 years ago. So they kind of already got theirs. Sons of bitches. Assholes. Okay. Oh, sorry. Foxconn. Last thing, I swear. They announced the major construction contractor. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. Who'd they give it to?
Some guy with the last name, H-A-M-M-E-S, who is the finance chair for Scott Walker's re-election campaign. It's his company.
Well, that's a coincidence.
I wonder.
Wait, wouldn't that mean that Scott Walker should have recused himself from that decision?
Fox, Conflicts well, I don't know if he... I mean, Foxconn would have announced this. Foxconn announced... Here, I'll read the... This is from Scott Bauer from the AP, it's a Wisconsin reporter. Foxconn announces that master planner for its massive campus in southeast Wisconsin will be, I don't know how you pronounce it, Hams Company. Hams is led by GOP mega donor John Hams, who is finance chairman for Scott Walker's re-election campaign. Hams also served in that role for Walker's presidential bid.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, to think that there's not shenanigans going on with Foxconn and Scott Walker is ridiculous. I swear to God, if he ever says the term drain the swamp and he's talking about fucking Madison, I will go berserk. I know he's already said some shit about Madison, but if he... Because we are kind of a swamp in terms of, like, actual geography.
Right.
So is D.C., too. I guess that's why that works. Okay, anyway, yeah, what's coming up for the week?
Trying to think. Congress is in session, so... Oh, Gina Haspel's nomination should be getting out of the Senate Intelligence Committee today. I think they may have already voted on it, or it's tomorrow that they're voting on it.
Okay.
It's tomorrow, yeah. So expect that to go through with Mark Warner, among others, voting in favor of it.
Okay. So a majority of Democrats voting against, but enough Democrats voting for that it'll pass pretty easily.
They negotiate that out, I'm sure. Other than that...
Let's point out that since our last episode, right after we did our last episode, the Trump administration did announce that they were pulling out of the Iran deal, and we had just recorded an episode essentially predicting that they would.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to...
Yeah, so we were right.
Just want to note that for the record.
The ramifications of that are still being determined. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the coming weeks. Bolton. Actually, if you want to talk about that for a second, you got me on another track. John Bolton this weekend went on This Week on ABC and demonstrated to the whole country that he does not understand how sanctions work and he doesn't understand diplomacy, seemingly.
How does he not understand the sanctions? Explain that.
He didn't get that there was a financial component. Like, the reason sanctions matter is because if the United States wants to, we can kick any country out of what they call the SWIFT system,
mm-hmm.
which is how international transactions are conducted.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have access to that, you are basically almost entirely cut off from the international community.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he apparently does not understand. Oh, wait, here's...
I mean, was he trying to say that they would be ineffective for things? Or is he proposing sanctions without knowing what sanctions are?
he's saying that we're going to do sanctions without understanding what that means. Because his point was that they were going to punish European countries whose companies continue to do business in Iran.
Oh, he's trying to do that?
Yeah, he's threatened that.
Well, isn't that a thing? Isn't that how sanctions partially work? Is that if you put a company or individual on a sanctions list and then a different company from a different country does business with them, don't you then sanction that company?
Yes. But yeah, it gets into some technical issues, and if you would want to, there's very limited utility in going after European companies, because, you know, we kind of need a long-term, stable relationship with Europe.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, of course. Of course.
Mm-hmm.
I think I saw this described, I was listening to something about Iran deal falling apart, repercussions of it or something. And anyway, theoretically, you're supposed to say, in this example, go after, sanction those European companies. But in the past, I believe it was in the 90s, many European countries passed laws telling their companies to ignore U.S. sanctions, specific U.S. sanctions. And the U.S. essentially backed down because of what you're talking about.
Hmm.
And
oh, wait. Yeah, I found the quote where Bolton makes his mistake. Europeans are going to face effective U.S. sanctions, already are, really, because much of what they would like to sell to Iran involves U.S. technology for which the licenses will not be available. Like, he's trying to make it about, you know, these technology transfer licenses when it's about something far more simpler, just pure finances and economics.
Yeah.
Because if companies do business with Iran after these sanctions are in effect, that means the U.S. government can entirely freeze their assets in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Which could be, you know, billion-dollar bank accounts for those giant German conglomerates.
Mm-hmm.
And it would keep them from being able to do business in the United States. Which, again, has terrible ramifications for us.
I got four letters for you. MAGA.
Yeah.
It's the only retort you need.
Make America gross again.
Make America grovel again.
Yeah, I mean, if they're trying to turn us into a pariah state because they think we're so much stronger than the rest of the world, when our strength vis-a-vis the rest of the world comes from how
mm-hmm.
they see us.
Yep. Yeah, at some point this becomes like in sports, a lot of times you'd be like, okay, who do you think's going to win the World Series this year? Do you take the Yankees or the field? Whereas, you know, you'll usually take the field.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, it's obvious. Because usually there's not one, like if you had to give percentage chances, you know, like a over 50% chance that any one team, or if you're talking about an individual sport, maybe that, you know, one individual player will win. And it seems like we're getting this way for the international politics, where it's like you take the U.S. or the field. And if we start making, if we start detaching ourselves from the field, then it kind of, then that question can be posed, and I don't think we're going to win. it's a ways off, but we're heading in that direction.
Yeah, we can't win by ourselves.
Dude, like, does he not understand, like, what empire or significant, you know, great
nation state?
Yeah, but I'm going more towards, like, the empire building thing. Like, works without allies. And you know, it just doesn't, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at its core.
Nope. I mean, it stems from a fundamentally flawed view of history, right?
Oh, I don't even know what view of history they're using, to be honest.
Well, I mean, I guess if you were like, oh, the Roman Empire did everything on its own, it's like, well, that's not even true either.
Yeah.
That depended on a delicate relationship with the other, like, not necessarily full states, but at least the vassal states that the Roman Empire kind of nurtured in its periphery.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there may have been, I mean, any of these great empires, nation-states, that you could look at in history, I'm sure had their moments of isolationism, and had their moments of breaking alliances.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, broadly speaking, and probably even specifically speaking, if we were to pick out any examples, those aren't the steps that led towards their increase in power.
No, almost never.
It probably usually is either a hiccup in that direction or the opposite, leading more towards downfall.
Mm-hmm.
God, damn it. Such a moron. I mean, he doesn't know, like, history. It's our stupid president. But, I mean, there's not even people around him that I would say seem to have much of a grasp of these things.
Right, because the Romans kind of depended on that German goodwill, and when they lost that, it was all over in the Western Roman Empire.
Oh, yeah, they were making, like, isn't it something like, oh, man, I don't know enough. I should probably just not open my mouth about Roman history, because I don't know enough. But I thought, as you're saying, they had goodwill, like, they were not so much bringing in German tribes underneath the empire, but they made sure to have peaceful relations on those northern borders as much as they could.
Yeah, with the Persians too? They never conquered Persia.
No, they did not conquer Persia.
So they had to be dealing with someone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like I think in a lot of these situations they had like buffers. Like, and I think the Roman Empire is a good one to look at. They would have, like, buffer states, buffer kingdoms, which maybe wouldn't technically be part of the empire, or were some sort of border state at best. But I'm sure at no point were they like, well, we have to stop paying for, you know, arming those people because we, you know, we have to make Rome great again. And then, like, if you just think historically, militarily, where does that lead? It leads to someone coming in and swooping in and becoming more of a power. You know? Like, if we're not helping out Western Europe or wherever, I don't know. I mean, maybe nothing's going to happen tomorrow or the next day, but in the long scheme of things, some other power is going to emerge.
Right, even, or they'll just take it upon themselves to be more proactive. I mean,
yeah,
Germany...
Yeah, in the case of Europe, it just might be them themselves, yeah.
Yeah, or they'll just start, well, they'll be kind of forced to look at their relationship with Russia.
Yeah, alright.
Yeah, terrible note to end it on, but...
It's hard not to end on terrible notes. It's like a terrible song. It's like you know, like the beginning of the Lord of the Rings, like Silmarillion. It's like they're singing this song, and then Melkor or whatever puts in these like dissonant notes and makes everything sound shitty. That's Trump. He's just making all conversations lead to shitty end notes. Alright, this is Tell Me What to Think. You can find me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis and Charles on Twitter at Green_Weird. Email us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. Email us. We have some cool guests coming up, not to name any names yet, before we actually record anything. But we should have some cool guests coming up. Email us if you would like to be a guest. Anything else you want to say, Charles?
Have a good week.
All right, everyone. Be good. Have fun.
Today's sunny. Today's rain. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains.